Stay with us and we're going to show you how to take dead aim.
Take dead aim.
The importance of taking dead aim.
Welcome to Taking Dead Aim, a show dedicated to the game of golf and the people who play it in the Carolinas and around the world. Taking Dead Aim is a presentation of RBC Wealth Management and Academy Sports and Outdoors. And now, here's your host, the man talking in your backswing, Charlie Nance.
Hey, welcome back. Once again, we're Taking Dead Aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. I'm Charlie Nance on Twitter, at CLT _ golf guy. To start, happy Memorial Day weekend. And I've heard people say before, how can you be happy about a memorial? Well, it's simple. We should all be happy, thrilled, overjoyed, and honored to pay tribute to all who have worn the uniform on our behalf. For those who've served, given all they had, and come home, thank you for your service. To those who did not return, I say to the relatives, thank you for your family's service and sacrifice. There may never be words to properly convey the gratitude I and this grateful nation feel. This week on tour marks the second week of the May Texas Two-Step, if you will, at the Fort Worth Invitational, historic Colonial Country Club, one of two tracks bearing the name Hogan's Alley. This course is one of our nation's and game's treasures, and I'm so happy to hear a sponsor has been secured so this event and site can continue on tour. I can't imagine a season without it. Hey, quick word about last week's Byron Nelson at a new course, Trinity Forest. I loved it, especially on Saturday when the winds blew. It had a very Aaron Hills-ish look to it and plays differently than most all tracks on tour. And this is a good thing. There's more than one way to play this game. And I like to see the best in the world challenged. On a related note, congratulations to Aaron Wise. All this kid does is win. At Oregon, as a sophomore, he won the individual NCAA title and led his team to the same. Since leaving, he's won on the Canadian Tour, the Web.com Tour, and now the PGA Tour. And did you see him on Sunday? The other side of your pillow ain't that cool. Get used to that name because it's going to be one you see on the top of leaderboards a lot. Hey, this week on the show, we pay tribute to Texas with a couple of books about Texas legends. Kevin Robbins will join us to talk about Harvey Pinnick, his book, The Life and Wisdom of the Man Who Wrote the Book on Golf. And Larry Miller speaks with us about Ben Hogan's secret fundamental. But first, we check in with Ron Green Jr. of the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer. Normally, I'd be talking with Ron Green Jr. about what's happening on the PGA Tour, what happened last week, but we're going to just bypass that for the time being, because jealous am I about an Irish golf trip that you took last week. Now, before you left, full disclosure, you said your game wasn't good for public display. How do you feel about your game now, having come back from Ireland?
Well, let me start by saying the first 18 holes we played at a place called Ardglass up in Northern Ireland, where Ed Sheeran had just played golf a few days before and had the little town abuzz about that. But I was not sure I could get myself through six rounds and buy enough golf balls to get me through them the way it started in the rain and the cold. But it got better from there. So I'm not excited about it, but I'm encouraged about it. How's that?
Okay, now let's compare, because I know that you've been over to Scotland many times to cover the Open Championship. This was your first trip to Ireland. How does the travel compare? Is it about the same? Is it easier to get into Ireland than it is to the spots of Scotland? What was your experience there?
Well, actually, it's my third trip to Ireland.
Oh, okay.
My first one since I went back in the late 80s, and I went for the Ryder Cup to K Club in 06, I guess it was. But first time back, I mean, it was great for me. I mean, we have direct flight from Charlotte to Dublin, and, you know, just get on a plane one afternoon and wake up the next, well, if you can sleep on a plane, which I can't, get up the next morning and you're there. So in that case, it's very similar, I think, to Scotland. I think if you didn't know one from the other, you probably couldn't tell. Maybe the roads are a little more narrow in spots in Ireland, I don't know. But I think it's very similar and in all the good ways. I mean, the great links courses up there in Ireland and the ones we played up in Northern Ireland are just, I mean, they're as good as anything in the world. And, you know, it's funny. Obviously, the political climate has changed in Northern Ireland over the last 20 years or so, and that's a good thing. And it's you didn't even know when you'd left Ireland for Northern Ireland until you tried to pay something, because in Ireland they're on the euro, and in Northern Ireland they're on the pound sterling thing. So if you didn't have one or the other, you were relying on your card a lot. But I highly recommend it, but we're doing our magazine, Global Golf Post, is doing a travel section about primarily about Northern Ireland, but about Ireland as well. It's going to run in July, so that's what I was over there for, and focusing on with the Open coming back to Port Rush for the first time in 68 years. And it's just terrific. I mean, if you like Lynx golf, you need to go.
Yeah, before we get to Royal Port Rush, I wanted to ask you, you brought up the political climate. I've been intrigued at how the Open Championship has not been to Ireland or Northern Ireland since, what was it, 1951 or 19, sometime in there.
Yeah, 51.
It's been a long, long time. And in my mind's eye, as I think about the United States Open and the United States, and I think about the Open Championship, that would be like the United States Open completely ignoring a third of the country as far as a site for all of those years. Was it the political climate? Was it the unrest and the violence? Is that what kept the tournament away?
Well, I think that factored into it later. I think there were other reasons. I think that they got, you know, and I don't know all the reasons, but I think they got into the pattern of England and Scotland, and that's what they wanted. And I think, you know, the sort of drumbeat of support for Port Rush in particular started building a few months back, a few years back, and they knew they had to change the golf course a little bit. The last two holes, as they used to exist, were fairly flat, benign finishing holes, so they went in and changed it, built two new holes that if you didn't know, you would never know were new, but one in particular is really, I thought, was spectacular. But I think they just decided it was time to expand. There was a lot of pressure on them from outside, you know, from Ireland, Northern Ireland. They wanted to do it. The players, I think when Rory, when Darren Clark, when Padraig Harrington, when Graham McDowell had the success they had, I think that was the sort of the impetus to really develop the momentum that led to this. I mean, I don't think this is a one and done at Port Rush. I think it's going to become part of a regular rotation of sorts. And I think that, you know, they've seen the success of the Irish Open. They're getting Rory behind it. You know, Graham McDowell is going to be a host in the future. Darren Clark is. You know, they played it at Port Rush. They had 130,000 people, I think, at Port Rush to see the Irish Open, which was convincing enough that, hey, they can do this up there. You know, they've been to Port Stewart. They're going to Ballyliffin this year. I think they have really good golf courses, and I think it was time. And I think the RNA saw it as a chance to go up there and maybe expand the footprint a little bit. And I think, Carnoustie will be great in its own beastly way this year, but I think there's a lot of excitement about what's going to happen next year.
Ron Green Jr. with the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer is our guest taking Dead Aim. Give me a gauge of the people's excitement about this. The Scottish people love the game so much, and there's a great reverence for it, and they are tremendous golf fans. But I would think that the Irish people, knowing that this huge event is coming, that they have to be giddy, right?
Yeah, I think so. Now, the ones we saw in particular in the town of Port Rush were giddy, but it might have been the Guinness more than anything else. As it coincided, we happened to be there during this big motorcycle race they have there. It's called the Northwest 200. It's a giant motorcycle rally, and they race these motorcycles through the streets of Port Rush literally at 200 miles an hour.
Wow.
I don't know who's foolish enough to do that, and I don't want to be anywhere near, but you could hear it when we were playing, and so the streets, I mean, it looks sort of like Race Week in Charlotte out on the track. All these flags around and all these campers and everything. But, yeah, there's a lot of enthusiasm there. As we went around, people would always talk about, well, we're so excited about the Open coming next year. And, you know, even if they weren't at Port Rush, if they were other places, it's a really big deal. And I think there's, Scotland sort of has the heritage of golf tag that it has uniquely to itself in a way, but I think Ireland is, it's sort of been in the shadows a little bit, but like I said, when you stack them up side by side, I mean, that's 1 and 1A over there.
So tell me about Royal Port Rush. I've only seen it, I think, once on the Golf Channel. They may have held the Irish Open there a few years ago, and I saw it then. But what is that golf course like? What is it comparable to as far as the Open Rota that you can compare?
It's just a big, brawny golf course. It's one that's just, it's fun to look at. It's fun to play. I mean, it makes you hit shots. You got to know where you're going. You got to have some sort of control. But we caught it on a nice day. It was cool. We didn't get a whole lot of wind, and we got enough that it mattered, but not what, I mean, you could get it, you know, 10,000 times more than we got there. I just think it's, it's just a classic big links. I'm trying to think what you could compare it to. It's not like the old course, which is very flat. I mean, this goes through some dunes and rumbles and rolls around out there.
Is it kind of like Turnberry in a way?
Yeah, probably not as definitely not as picturesque as Turnberry, but maybe some like that. I was thinking not as bumpy and everything as St. George's, not like Carnoustie, because nothing's really like that.
No.
Maybe like Turnberry some. And I just think, you know, it seems like it would give you a good, full, thorough test, which is what you want. You know, as we were there, they were still, they had all this machinery there. They're clearing some places out. They were already sort of building the pad just on the ground there for the Open Championship Village, for the entryway for people, where different things are going to be. So you could sort of, you know, there was no physical structures, but you could see the scars, so to speak, of where they've done the work and where they're doing the work to get it all ready. And the golf course, you know, it's pretty soft start in a way. It's funny, it's a downhill par four that goes back up a straightaway, but it's got out of bounds on both sides of it. I mean, and there's not really like anything beside there. I mean, I actually hit my first tee shot out of bounds and didn't even realize it was out of bounds because I just thought I hit it down the right side. Guy says, you're going to need to hit another one. That one's out of bounds. I mean, there's just this line of white posts down there. I'm like, oh, I thought it wasn't even a bad shot, you know? And then you realize, like, oh, okay, I got to foot it between these two things. So, but after that, I mean, it just gets out there, and there's some really fun shots to hit. And it's just, it's just fun to play and good and strong and all the things a place like that's supposed to be.
Ron Green Jr. with the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer, fresh off an Ireland golf trip, is our guest taking Dead Aim. So, other than Portrush, and I forget the name of the one you started out with, where else did you play?
We went over the next day. We played. We actually stayed. We couldn't play Royal County Down, which is ranked number one in the world by a lot of people. We stayed literally right next door. I could look out my window and see the gate, broad iron gate to Royal County Down. But the Irish Amateur was being played, so we went over and looked around a little bit. A little bad timing on our part. But then we went to Port Stewart, which has hosted the Irish Open,
right,
and may have the most dramatic opening tee shot I've seen anywhere in golf. It's you're atop a dune. You play down to a fairway that doglegs right, but it's surrounded by these big towering dunes. And it's, I mean, you just want to sit there. You'd like to just have a rocking chair and nowhere to go. And you just sit and look. The ocean's over to the right and all that is just – the first eight holes are as good of eight-hole stretch as you're going to find anywhere. I mean, it is pure links through the dunes. Then the back nine sort of flattens out and goes out into not pasture land, parkland, but compared to what you played at the start, it's much flatter and softer type thing. But really, really good. I'd recommend that for sure. And the surprise to me maybe was Ballyliffin, where they have 36 holes there and they have a newer course called the Glashidi Links, which is this thing called the Glashidi Rock that sits out in the ocean you see. And anyway, the Irish opens there this year, and it's a really good golf course. Got the big dunes and everything, a little more playable. You know, some of the places like Portrush and Port Stewart, if you miss it a little ways off the fairway, you might find it. You know, you certainly go look for it, but you might not find it. Ballyliffin, if you miss it off the fairway, it's still thick and wispy and looks like these famous Irish links do, but you could tend to find it's thinner. They had a nice height to it, and it was manageable. So I think that for those of us who don't have a whole lot of faith in our tee shots, sometimes it was it gave you a little more comfort that if you missed it a little bit, you could still go find it. That's terrific. And then I had not been back to Ballybunion in 30 years, and I was hoping that it was not going to be like that, going back to a high school reunion 30 years later and, you know, the girl you had the crush on in high school, you see her and you realize, not the same person I remember. I mean, I'm trying to say that delicately. And the same, of course, could be said for her looking at us.
Yes.
But it was as good or better than I imagined. And the guys I was with who played a lot of those great golf courses, you know, it was the last one when I was with them, and I was thinking, okay, it starts off pretty benign, or, you know, good, but not dramatic. And you actually play along a road and a trailer park. The fifth green sits, I mean, you could scull a wedge shot into somebody's double wide over there, and there's a net there, and it's sort of like, this is the Great Bally Bunyan. And then all of a sudden you get to that seventh tee, and you turn, you step up there and turn back. And from there on, I mean, you better bring everything you got, because it is just fantastic. And we caught it on a rainy day, one of those soaking days, the last five or six holes. It didn't matter. I mean, I was having so much fun, because it's just, it looks almost prehistoric in places.
Oh, wow.
And it's just, it was my favorite before I went in Ireland, and it reinforced the fact that it's still my favorite over there.
You didn't get to play it, but you mentioned it, and that's Royal County Down. I hear a lot about that golf course. Is there talk of perhaps one day it hosting an Open or a Ryder Cup?
I haven't heard that. I want to say there's a reason. I don't know if it's infrastructure or getting around there. There's not a whole lot there, I don't think. But I don't know why, because it's gotten, you know, people rave about it, and everybody says, oh, my gosh, I feel bad for you. You didn't get to play it. I know that, you know, it's got a lot of blind shots. If it has a wrap on it, it's that too many sort of blind shots in the spots. But, I mean, it just, the little bit we got to see and, you know, hanging around the pro shop and doing our souvenir shop and all that stuff, it was enticing. And who knows, maybe next year when that Open Championship rolls around through Northern Ireland, maybe I'll find a way to get up there and check that box too.
Ron Green Jr. with the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer, our guest, taking Dead Aim fresh off an Ireland golf trip. Get you out of here on this. Put into perspective from an American point of view, how big a star is Rory McIlroy in his home country?
He's a huge star. I mean, I think, you know, he's a huge star here. I think even bigger there. I think, and collectively those guys, like I said, Harrington and Graham McDowell and Darren Clark, what they've done, you know, I think they're sort of the Mount Rushmore of Irish golf now, and Rory is the star of stars among them. And I think, you know, he took on the Irish Open and sort of making it a project of his. And, I think he is, he's right at the heart of what golf is over there from the professional game. And, you know, it's a big deal. Very much like in Scotland, when you drive from town to town, each town has its golf course. It's the same way in Ireland. And, you know, there are plenty of them that you're not as familiar with, but like Rosapenna and Port Salon and Enniscrone and things like that, that are just spectacular golf courses that if you get the chance to go over there and spend some time, it's terrific. I mean, we drove the length and breadth of the country 5 hours from where we were at one point down to Lahinch to play. And, you know, you go to Lahinch, which has two of the most famous holes in the game, that blind par three, the right. Dell hole. And there on a 65-degree day, there's 200 people out surfing in the water, you know, right off the golf course there. And I'm sitting there still got my underlayer on and everything. And I'm like one of the Irish guys says, I mean, it was sunny and got close to 70 that day. And he goes, we get a day like this and we all do the same thing. We all walk outside and take our clothes off and go,
How great is that? I want to leave for Ireland, like now. From the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer, Ron Green Jr. And when we return, Kevin Robbins joins us to take Dead Aim at his book about the life of one of golf's most famous teachers. Presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. We are taking Dead Aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. Harvey Pienick was the teacher of Ben Crenshaw and Tom Kite from the time they were boys in Austin. Late in life, he became a best-selling author of The Little Red Book, a collection of his simple thoughts on golf instruction. And not too long ago, I had the chance to speak with Kevin Robbins, who's written a book about this great man. You know, looking at Harvey's life, this could never happen today. From the age of 8, when he became employed as a caddy, he only had one employer until he died in his 90s. That's Austin Country Club. That's insane.
It is. We really don't even have caddies much anymore, and certainly not 8 years old. But in 1912... Austin was still kind of a frontier city, and Austin Country Club was still relatively new, and golf certainly was relatively new to the people in Austin. They didn't know what it was about or how to play it. It was brought to the city by a man, Lewis Hancock, who went to an Ivy League college and met people there who had been to Scotland and talked to him about this fascinating game. And he traveled to the UK and he played it abroad, came back to Austin just like bursting with enthusiasm about this new game in which you hit a ball with a stick into a hole, and they fashioned this crude
which is exactly
layout.
How a Texan would describe it, by the way. Y'all got to see this game. You take this ball and whack it with a stick till it goes in a hole.
Oh, you're going to love this detail. At the first Austin Country Club, where Harvey became a caddy in 1912, they had a hitching post, which was actually a hitching tree, where members could tether their horses to the tree while they went out and played this new game.
That is so fantastic. And then, at age 13, I want you to think about what you were doing at 13. Harvey Peanut becomes the assistant head professional, and then was promoted to head professional after he graduated from high school. I mean, so this is lofty responsibility for someone of 13 and 18.
It is, but, you know, they were just kind of figuring things out, and there were no expectations. There was no precedent. There was no peer to follow. They were just sort of bumbling along, doing things as they discovered them, which really was the way that Harvey taught and learned golf his entire life. It was by watching and witnessing. Harvey wasn't an educated man. As you mentioned, he did go to high school. He had to wait until his graduation to become the head professional at the age of 18. But he didn't go to a PGA school. He didn't go away to learn on the range of some East Coast country club with some esteemed professional how to teach golf. He figured it out by watching good results and bad results, and he taught what he saw in the good results, and he did not teach what he saw in the bad results. And so his whole life was just kind of figuring things out through experience.
I remember growing up in Houston, there was a legendary coach at the University of Houston, Dave Williams, won in the teens, I think, national titles at U of H. Dave was not a good golfer. I always found it interesting that he was such a good coach, but not good at the sport that he was coaching. By the time I met Harvey, Harvey was a very old man and had long since given up swinging a golf club. What kind of player was Harvey?
Harvey was a fantastic player, Charlie. He played in what would be the precursor to the PGA Tour circuit in Texas and a little bit beyond. He played with some really notable players in Texas. He qualified for and played in the 1928 U.S. Open at Olympia Fields. And there's a very interesting story that Harvey was reluctant to share because he just didn't talk about himself a whole lot. At that 1928 U.S. Open in Chicago, he played a practice round behind Bobby Jones. And on a particular par three hole, Harvey hit a shot with a spoon, which I think is the equivalent of the three wood now, or the three metal. Mm-hmm. He hit the shot up to about 4 feet, I mean, very close. And as he walked up to the green, he saw Bobby Jones lurking off to the side. And Bobby simply said, "Nice shot," to Harvey. And Harvey always remembered that. It's not a story that he told many people. I heard it on a cassette tape of one of the early interviews with Bud Schrake. But that acknowledgement must have been enormous for Harvey, because he so looked up to Bobby Jones and to Bobby's teacher, Stuart Maiden, at East Lake Country Club in Atlanta. For the years that Harvey was the head professional at Austin Country Club, he had a poster of Bobby Jones at the finish of his golf swing, and he wanted all of his students to see that Bobby Jones kept his forearms in front of him against his chest at all parts of the swing. That's how much he admired Bobby Jones.
Kevin Robbins is the author of the book Harvey Peanut, The Life and Wisdom of the Man Who Wrote the Book on Golf. He's our guest taking Dead Aim. Because of Harvey's upbringing and how he went from the caddy yard to being the club professional and learning things in the dirt on the range, it sounds very similar in some respects to two other famous Texans, Ben Hogan and Byron Nelson. I have never seen or read or heard of any sort of relationship, certainly not on a teaching level, but as comrades,
comrades, as friendship. Did he have a relationship with either Hogan or Nelson?
He did, and he was very close with Byron Nelson. I don't know of many people who were authentically close to Ben Hogan, but they did know each other, and they did take golf together. In fact, in the spring of 1950, and this would have been after Hogan's accident in West Texas, as he was recuperating and beginning to return to the form that won the 1950 U.S. Open at Oakland Hills, Hogan played an exhibition in Austin at Lyons Municipal Golf Course with Harvey Penick as his partner. They were playing against two up-and-coming college players. It was an exhibition and benefit for the Lions Club. It was the biggest event of the season in Austin. It even beat out, say, Texas football. People lined up for miles to come watch the great Hogan play their golf course. And they played 18 holes against these two college amateurs. They did lose, but I'm not sure how much Harvey contributed to the effort. But he and Hogan did know each other. They did play together. Late in Hogan's life, when he was retired from professional golf and pretty much just spending his time at Shady Oaks Country Club in Fort Worth, he once told someone from Austin that he had a hitch in his swing, and he said, "Tell Harvey Penick that I'm going to come see him," but he never did.
Interesting story about Harvey, and I want to get into his teaching method, the simplicity of his teaching method, which is what set Harvey apart. By the time I met Harvey, it was in the early 90s. It was before the Little Red Book came out, and this was after Austin Country Club had moved to its current location. And Harvey, every weekend on Saturday and Sunday mornings, was sort of like the honorary starter. He was there on the first or 10th tee to greet and talk to everybody. One of the guys that I was with told a story with Harvey about the guy's brother. His name was George Rives, and George was on the mini tours. And George played a 5-yard draw, and all of a sudden it became a 5-yard fade. And it was driving him crazy. And he called Harvey, and he said, just in a panic, and said, "I got to come see you. I got to come see you. I just don't know what to do." And Harvey's blood pressure never got above 40. And he said, "Well, George, come on in." And so George came in, and he said, "George, tell you what, why don't you, go get you a bag and head over to the range, and I'll be there in a few minutes to look at you." So George gets warmed up, and Harvey shows up, and George takes out the driver, and he starts hitting these. And this is with, Balata balls and persimmon woods, close to 300-yard drives that were ending up just right of center in the fairway with a little 5-yard fade. And he said, "See what I'm talking about? Look at this." He says, "I play a 5-yard draw. I can't." And Harvey looked at him and said, "Well, take a couple more swings." Took 5 more swings, each of them close to 300 yards, 5-yard fade. Right center of the fairway. He says, "Harvey, what am I going to do?" He says, "George, I suggest you start aiming 5 yards left." walked off the range. And when they told that story, Harvey remembered it immediately, said, "Absolutely, that happened."
Harvey was a scion of simplicity. And that's why I think he's as relevant today as he was in 1950, 60, and 92 when the Little Red Book came out, because I believe that there's a certain segment of people who play this game, and I identify with this group myself, who find it far too cluttered and complicated and noisy and loud. And I'm not talking about everybody, but I'm talking about some of us. And I think that the simplicity and the clarity and the economy of thought and just the practicality and pragmatism that Harvey brought to the instruction of this sport is valuable. It's necessary. And that story you just told is exactly that kind of pragmatism. I think that if an instructor is being paid a great sum of money to teach someone, and that gentleman you spoke of came and was concerned about this 5-yard fade, that some instructors would feel compelled to try to figure out how to get him hitting that 5-yard draw again. But Harvey, man, he just saw things so clearly and so practically, and that's how he expressed that message. That's a fantastic story, and it's so, so Harvey Penick.
Kevin Robbins is the author of the book, Harvey Penick, The Life and Wisdom of the Man Who Wrote the Book on Golf. He's our guest Taking Dead Aim. Let's talk about that Little Red Book, because that's really when Harvey's name started to become in the forefront of players and teachers alike, the world over, actually. It was the Little Red Book, and the Little Red Book was based on an actual red book that he kept notes on for since the start of his teaching days, wasn't it?
It was hard to figure out exactly, Charlie, when he started keeping those notes. They aren't dated. And the only way that I could really reference when he began writing these notes was the names that he would include and the places that he would include. But let's say, for instance, he started keeping it at about 1950. And that's my best estimate based on when the company that was producing this particular notebook called Scribbletex was in business in Dallas. So, yes, you're right. He started jotting down these notes in this Scribbletex notebook that he kept in a roll-top desk for himself. Now, old son later became a golf professional. Harvey had the mind that he was going to give these notes to his son, but he never had any illusion that this was going to be any sort of book. That all changed in the spring of 1991. Harvey was 86 years old. He was frail. He was diminished. His back had been broken. He had had cancer. And I believe that he was beginning to look retrospectively at his life, and he was taking inventory of everything that he had been privileged to be around and learn golf. And I think he began to feel a little guilty about keeping this notebook just for himself or just for his son. And so he called a mutual friend, a man named Bud Schrake, who had been a writer for Sports Illustrated magazine, kind of a bon vivant, bigger-than-life guy who had lived in New York and dined at Elaine's. And he had Bud out to the country club, and he said, "Bud, do you think we can put this into some sort of publishable form? I think it would be a good instruction book for my fellow PGA professionals." And Bud took a look at it. It's all of 6,600 words. There's no narrative. There's no cohesion to it. It's just a jumble of notes. And Bud, he saw the treasure in this, and he saw the potential, and he said, "Yes, Harvey, I think we can do it." And that became the Little Red Book less than a year later.
Harvey Pienick worked, we all know he worked with Tom Kite and Ben Crenshaw since they were boys. He worked with Mickey Wright, Betsy Ross, Kathy Whitworth. Yet, until the Little Red Book came out, Harvey's name was never mentioned in the same sentence like you have today with the Ledbetters and the Harmons and the Haneys of the world. I already know the answer to this question before I ask, but was he resentful in any way that his teachings weren't as highly regarded as these other people?
Oh, I don't think so, Charlie. First of all, it's not the kind of person he was. And Harvey always identified as a caddy first. And that was just how he saw himself, a humble, gracious, thankful steward of the game, but never any sort of vanguard leader of golf instruction. And in fact, his teachings are not vanguard. They're not revolutionary. They're very actually primal. So I don't think, but Harvey was never a resentful person at his core anyway. So I don't think he much cared. I think he was actually slightly amused at the idea of the celebrity golf professional, someone who sort of took the stage and demanded the spotlight. I think Harvey privately probably shook his head and thought, you know, what is that all about? So no, I don't think he was resentful at all.
You know, every year at the Masters, they replay 1995 and Crenshaw's putt and the putting his hands on his head. And the story's always retold about Harvey's death that week and him going home. I've always thought and wondered if Harvey every year was watching this on the Masters, if he would just say, "Okay, enough already. I didn't make a shot. Crenshaw did all the work." It just seemed to me that he would not like getting as much credit as even Crenshaw gives him for that.
It's possible. But at the same time, he and Ben were so close, and he knew how important he was to Ben. I think he'd be grateful for his connection to golf history in that way. But because it was Ben, who produced that win, and that Harvey really had no tangible connection to the win. You know, it's interesting to listen to Ben talk about 1995. Even today, I was on the radio with him about 3 months ago, and we were discussing this very thing. And Ben struggles, even 20 years later, to talk about how that happened. He has no idea. I mean, it was a matter of grace. And it's just Ben still can't put a finger on how he was able to do that at the age of 43, a week after Harvey died.
Kevin Robbins is the author of the book, Harvey Pienick, The Life and Wisdom of the Man Who Wrote the Book on Golf. He's our guest, Taking Dead Aim. Get you out of here on this. All the research you did, all the interviews you conducted, all the stuff that you looked at about Harvey Pienick, what surprised you most about this man?
Wow, that's a really great question. And it's one I've considered. And to be honest, there were no surprises. And I'm grateful that there weren't any, because I think we all have this image of who Harvey was and how he lived his life and what he means to golf and what his legacy is and always should be. And I found nothing to shatter that. I think, though, that the most surprising fact about Harvey that I perhaps knew but now have a greater appreciation for is that thing we were talking about earlier, how fine a player he was, that perhaps if he had committed to the other side of professional golf, and that is playing golf, that maybe he would be mentioned in the same sentences as Hogan and Snead and Byron Nelson. But he chose at a very early age to teach golf instead of play it for a living. And that's why we have him as he is now.
A great Father's Day idea for the golfer in your home. The book is Harvey Pienick, The Life and Wisdom of the Man Who Wrote the Book on Golf, the author, Kevin Robbins. And up next, the great Ben Hogan's secret. Does this man know it? Author Larry Miller takes Dead Aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. Hey there, we're taking Dead Aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. Larry Miller has written Ben Hogan's Secret Fundamental, and a couple of years ago we had this conversation. Larry, let me start with the obvious. I'm a Ben Hogan junkie. My son is not named Hogan after the wrestler, okay? So I've consumed all I can over the years, and there's been some great biographies. Kurt Sampson's written one. James Dotson's written one. I had Tim Scott on the show not too long ago. He did one. Chris Cheddar and John Mahaffey have all written about their experiences with the man. Hogan himself co-authored what may be, I think, the best-selling instruction book of all time. So what to you makes your book, Ben Hogan's Secret Fundamental, different?
Well, through the decades, at least five decades, you know, every teacher, I mean, every great teacher, every great player has offered their opinion, speculated on what Hogan's secret was. And, you know, interestingly, they're all different. And, you know, what they were pointing out, and also interestingly, everything that they pointed out was correct. But those were features of his swing. They were just features of his golf swing, the cupped left wrist, the right knee. You know, I could take your swing, Charlie, and you know, point out four or five things and say, look, there's Charlie's secret when he hits good shots, you know. But I'm just pointing out features of your golf swing. Hogan found something much more basic, much more fundamental and basic than just a feature. It wasn't just one little feature. He figured out a geometry. You know, Hogan had a very analytical mind, despite not a lot of formal education, but he was a very smart guy, very inquisitive, and as I said, analytical. And, of course, along with his endless practice, you know, digging it out of the dirt, hitting, you know, thousands of balls a week, Hogan eventually figured out a basic structure, a geometry based on mathematics of the golf swing that would ensure accuracy and power. Now, according to Tommy Bolt, who was my teacher in my early 20s before I played the tour, only Ken Venturi and himself, Tommy Bolt, were entrusted with the entirety of that structure of what Hogan found. And the reason he, you know, it wasn't that he wanted to be secretive, but Hogan was afraid that what he found would be distorted. If it were put out there, you know, and misunderstood and distorted through time, it would do more harm than good. So you know, his two main proteges while he was still playing was Venturi and Bolt. And of course, both of them became U.S. Open winners and Hall of Fame members, not coincidentally, and both credited Hogan with their success. They were both pallbearers at his funeral, and the stipulation was, you know, he came to trust those two guys, and the stipulation was that it could not be put out there until all the principals were gone, including Ben's wife, Valerie, because Ben did not want, he didn't want his wife at an elderly, you know, age to be bombarded with questions. So that was the stipulation. Now, in the 3 years that Bolt coached me and worked with me, he eventually came to tell me all about this basic structure and geometry. So, you know, I couldn't say anything, although I've taught for many, many years using those principles, but I didn't say anything about Hogan. Well, all these books started coming out. As you mentioned, Tim Scott's book, Chris Shetter, Mike Tolles wrote a great book. All these books started coming out, and all of them, you know, would speculate on Hogan's secret. Well, I finally decided that, and I went to see Tommy Bolt about 4 months before he passed away. He had retired up to Cherokee Village, Arkansas. And at that time, Tommy said, look, he said, in the future, he said, when we're all gone, if you can do justice to this, if you can put it out there accurately and in a way that will benefit the average player, feel free to do it. So eventually, when all these books started coming out, I said, you know what, we don't have to worry about the secrecy anymore, the privacy. All these books are out. So I decided to do it. I had to dig up, you know, 40-year-old notes and pictures and all sorts of stuff and try to piece it together exactly the way it was taught to me from Bolt. And so that's what I did. And that's why I decided to do it and how it came about. And what makes it different is that this is the basic structure, the secret of the golf swing, according to Ben Hogan, and it's not just a feature of a swing. You know, he would pull people aside and say, look, do this, don't tell anybody I told you. You know, and of course, what he was doing was he was giving them information appropriate to their golf swing, but he didn't want them to spread it around because it might not apply to every time Dick and Harry, just them, and that's why he did that. So anyway, that's kind of how it came about, and what drove me to finally say, you know what, enough's enough. Let's get down, you know, to it and really, really put it out there, what Hogan really found.
Larry Miller's the author of Ben Hogan's Secret Fundamental. He's our guest taking Dead Aim on America's Pulse 1660. All right, Larry, what if I was to play devil's advocate and talk about Hogan's freakish flexibility, gymnast-like balance, and astonishing hand strength, along with unparalleled work ethic and determination as a reason why he was able to get away with some of the things like a very neutral grip and that cupped wrist at the top? The normal player, we can't do that.
Well, here's the deal. The basic geometry that he found, if the average player will just work toward that geometry, you know, by following drills, practicing positions that apply to that geometry that coincide with it, it's all based on parallel lines, right angles, circles, and triangles. And the average player can work themselves closer and closer toward that geometry, and the closer they get, the better they're going to get at their ball striking, the more accurate, the more power. And that's the point. Yeah, and I say in the book that nobody's going to swing like Hogan. He was almost a freak. He could take his right thumb and bend it back and touch his right wrist, his forearm.
Oh.
That's how flexible he was in his wrists and his hands and fingers. And nobody's going to be able to do that. Hogan was 5'7", 150 pounds, and could hit it 300 yards when he wanted to with a wooden driver and a Bellotta golf ball because of the lag he could produce because of that flexibility in his right wrist. And he was very strong in his hands. And, yeah, the average player is not Hogan. They don't have those characteristics, but that's the whole point. The geometry that he found and what he followed can be worked toward by anybody. And as I said, you could take, I don't care if it's a tour player, and I've worked with several tour players, or a scratch amateur, or a 10 handicap, or a 30 handicap. If that player will work more and more toward the geometry that Hogan found, they're going to get better and better and better. Even Jordan Spieth. Look what happened last year at the Masters. He had a 5-shot lead going to the back nine, shot 41 because he couldn't find the fairway. Why? because of timing. His timing got off.
Well, now, wait. Larry, come on. The guy rents two balls on 12. That's what cost him the Masters, not finding a fairway at Augusta National. He had two birdies after that.
Well, that's right, but he shot 41 on the back nine.
With a seven or an eight on number 12.
Yeah, that's right. But just go back and take a look at his last nine holes. Last 11 holes, really.
Well, I get that. He had a five-shot lead on 10, yeah. But he shoots a 41 on the back. He had a 7, which is 4 over par. You subtract that, he shot 1 over on the back if he makes par on 12. So I don't know if that's as much about missing fairways at Augusta National, because like I point out, he had two birdies after 12 as much as it is that you know, he got bit by number 12 at Amen Corner like Weisskopf and Strange and others have done over the years.
Yeah, Weisskopf's famous 13.
Yeah.
Well, but it was obvious that Jordan's timing was off on the back nine. There's no question about it. Timing was off. See, Hogan wanted a swing that did not rely on timing. You know, Tiger Woods has a new book out. Are you familiar? It's called The Masters, 1997, My Story. It's a fabulous book. Lauren Rubenstein co-wrote it with Tiger. It just came out. It's number one on the golf book ranking. And I've read it already. It's a fabulous book. Okay. On page 4, on page 175, and on page 176, Tiger Woods talks about why he changed his swing after winning the Masters by 12 shots and the U.S. Open by 15 shots. And he clearly says on those pages, you can look it up, that he changed his swing because his swing relied on timing. And when it was on, he was fabulous, and when it was off, he hit bad shots. That's why he changed his swing. He was trying to make it better mechanically and not rely on timing. Says it clearly. That's the whole premise of Hogan's structure and geometry, is to be able to not rely on timing, be so mechanically sound that timing doesn't enter the equation. Let me give you a little statistic here. The leading greens and regulation player on the PGA Tour historically every year is around 13.1 to 13.7 greens. That means that the best ball strikers on earth are missing 4 to 5 greens around. Hogan averaged over 15 and a half. So you don't think he knew something that nobody else did? I mean, that's an enormous.
Oh, there's no question. I remember talking with Johnny Miller one time, and we were discussing scoring averages and things like that, and he said, you know, we didn't care about those things. When you came into the locker room, no one asked what you shot. We wanted to know how many fairways and how many greens you got. That's how we judged who the best ball strikers and golfers were. Larry Miller is the author of Ben Hogan's Secret Fundamental. He's our guest, Taking Dead Aim on America's Pulse 1660. There's other things about Hogan in the book that you go over that I think really can apply to everyone if we all could learn them. One thing I think all of us, especially those that compete in the game, are envious of when it comes to Hogan, was his power of focus and concentration under pressure. Where did this come from with him, and is it something that can be taught or learned?
Yeah, it can be learned. It's a method, you know, it's a technique, and he intentionally, you know, everybody thought that he was cold and antisocial, you know, and an assassin on the golf course because he wouldn't talk to anybody. Well, he didn't talk to anybody because he'd be distracted. If he would get drawn into a conversation, it would distract him from the strategy he was trying to use. You know, Hogan was a chess master when it came to course management. I mean, he won more tournaments with that than anything else, despite his great ball striking. But he was a master at course management. He would walk the course backwards before a tournament just to figure out where the safe landing areas were.
You know, I've always heard about doing that. I've never done it, but I've always heard about doing that, and it makes sense when you say it out loud, but you go into detail. I mean, there's a couple of architects out there. One of them, you know, there's a special, very warm place in hell for Pete Dye. And but you even talk about Dye's courses on there, and that Dye from the tee plays tricks with your mind and tricks with your eyes. And if you walk backwards on a Pete Dye course, you will see safe landing areas and things that are hidden from view off the tee box. And you know, a lot of times you'll get a chance to do that. But I would say if you do walk a course in reverse, that's one of the smartest things I've ever heard.
Well, you know, for you listeners out there, your home course where you play all the time, you probably have never walked it backwards. Try it sometime. Make notes and look at each hole from the green back to the tee. You're going to be amazed at the different perspective and how much safe area there really is on each hole. And that can really really enhance your scoring, because then you, for one thing, you can play to safe areas. And the second thing is it gives you more confidence standing back on that tee box knowing how much safe area you have. So I would recommend that as a real shot saver to anybody. And, of course, Hogan, you know, he did that with every before every tournament. And, yeah, and Pete Dye, you're right. He's an illusionist, you know, and scares you to death on the tee box.
One of the last things you discuss in the book, and I found it interesting because it's something that Hogan himself set apart from the game of golf, was putting. He famously regarded it as something completely separate from playing golf. He was never regarded as a great putter. And, of course, it came out later that the car crash of 49 almost completely robbed him of sight in one eye. But how much time did Hogan spend working on his putting? It was probably nowhere near what he spent hitting a golf ball. But, you know, look, you can hate it all you want, but at the end of the day, it's not how you drive, it's how you arrive. How much time did Hogan put into his putting?
Well, that's interesting. You know, Freddie Haas told me, Freddie's from New Orleans, where I'm from. He was one of my early mentors. Freddie was a contemporary of Hogan, played hundreds of competitive rounds with him. Freddie's the one that broke Byron Nelson's streak of 11 straight by winning the Memphis Open. Anyway, Freddie was a tremendous putter. Arnold Palmer said he was the best putter he ever saw. Freddie told me that early in Hogan's career, he was a really great putter from 6 feet and under, that he hardly ever missed on those short putts. Now, after the wreck that Hogan had and the residual effects from that, eventually the eyesight in his left eye was impaired, and I think that affected his putting a great deal. Hogan practiced his putting a lot early in his career, but when he started having trouble with it, you know, he sort of just bagged it, you know, and he didn't practice putting that much, fiddled with it a little bit, but he kind of knew that he just, you know, he wasn't the same, and so he concentrated on his ball striking. And, you know, he's the opposite. Some of these modern players, they miss 5-6 greens around, but their short game bails them out. Hogan was almost the opposite. You know, his long game bailed him out because he hit so many greens and had so many short birdie putts. That he could wiggle a few in here and there, you know, and still score low because he didn't miss many greens and make many bogeys. And he hardly ever made a double because Hogan's cardinal rule was to never short side himself. And that's another tip for your listeners out there. Pay attention to that. That's how you make doubles and triples, is by short siding yourself. And if you just play the percentages, if the pin's way on the right, play to the left center of the green. Vice versa. I mean, always give yourself a little margins to not get short-sighted. It's a lot easier to get it up and down when you have 50 feet of green to work with than 12 feet.
Get you out of here on this. We've all heard great Hogan stories over the years. I was fortunate one afternoon when I was living and working in Augusta to spend some time with Ken Venturi in a golf clubhouse after a round of golf. It was just a freaky scene. I'm there with Ken Venturi and Frank Cherkinian for a couple of hours, just us in a clubhouse. It was strange. But I heard him tell just some great stories. I heard about the match at Cypress Point from his mouth, shot by shot, years before the book came out. All the ones that he tells, I'll never forget the look in his eyes and the way he told them. It was with the love of a son. He always felt like Hogan had somewhat adopted him. What is your favorite Hogan story?
You know, one of my favorites is the Ryder Cup in 1967 when Hogan was captain of the Ryder Cup team. It was at Houston Country Club. And Arnold Palmer, of course, was in his prime at the time. And he was on the team. And at that time, you still had the option of playing the old British ball, you know, that was 1.62 inches and
right,
a little smaller than the American ball. And it would go, you know, and I've played with that ball. It would truly go 15 to 20 yards longer. It was just longer. And that's why eventually it was outlawed. But you still had that option back in 67. So Hogan was not about to give up, you know, 15, 20 yards to the Europeans, so he told the team when they started their practice rounds that they had to start practicing with the small ball, the European ball. Well, Palmer didn't like that idea a whole lot, you know, and he goes up to Ben and he says, Ben, you know, he said, I didn't bring any of those balls with me. And Hogan looks at Palmer and says, who said you're playing?
Ben Hogan's Secret Fundamental is the book, the author, Larry Miller. I'd also like to thank the writer of Harvey Pienick, the life and wisdom of the man who wrote the book on golf, Kevin Robbins, and Ron Green Jr. of the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer for their time and insight this week. A reminder, should you just be catching the last little bit of the show and wonder what all we've covered today, no worries. Just subscribe to the Taking Dead Aim podcast at Apple Podcasts, and it will automatically download to the device of your choice most weeks, just minutes after this terrestrial radio version of the show finishes airing. Additionally, a great source of constant golf updates is our Facebook page. Be sure to like us on Facebook. Just search Taking Dead Aim. Again, this Monday is Memorial Day. As you spend time reveling in our freedoms this weekend, take a moment to give thanks to those who've worn the uniform to ensure them for us. Weather-wise, well, hit and miss storms to dodge, but still plenty of opportunity to tee it up and let this game continue to haunt our souls and break our hearts. And if you do put a peg in the ground, remember to exhale, swing, pose, and keep it in the short grass. I'm Charlie Nance on Twitter at @CLT_golfguy, and I'll see you right here next week, Taking Dead Aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors.